if people are going to consume things, small, big, medium size, and they cannot acquire any more space because it prohibits, they just don't have income. They don't have the ability. It's not there. The cost is so much higher. That stuff has to go somewhere. They're going to have to put it somewhere in storage, and they're not going to throw it away.
This is the Self-Storage Podcast, where we share the knowledge and skills from the industry's leading investors, developers, and operators to help you launch and grow your self-storage business. Your host, Scott Myers, over the past 16 years, has acquired, developed, converted, and syndicated over 2 million square feet of self-storage nationwide with the help of his incredible team at selfstorageinvesting.com. Who has helped thousands of people achieve greatness in self-storage.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Self-Storage Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Myers, and we have a returning guest, Jeremiah Boucher with a Patriot Storage. Jeremiah, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Scott. Good to have me.
Well, today, Jeremiah and I were in the green room, and we were discussing the topic or the topics to chat about today. And I think the overarching topic is we are in a time of change. We are adapting. We are pivoting. And so as we're looking at interest rates, as everybody's trying to guess that puzzle piece and how do we underwrite and which deals survive and which deals do we let fall off the desk or hit the pause button? How do we approach our investors who are also looking to us as being the experts of the syndicators, the sponsors, to have the answers and to help them make an informed decision when it comes to them investing their hard-earned dollars with us? And then now also, what does it look like to our existing clients and rates right now? What are street rates looking like? How do we handle the rates for our existing clients as we're heading into an environment in which we're seeing some development, some overdevelopment, perhaps in some areas, and then also the changing business and pricing models? How do we appropriately handle that from a budgeting standpoint and from a rate standpoint? And so we touch on each of those buckets today. Jeremiah, I'm going to throw it over to you. Take a pick, whichever one of those you want to address first, we'll dive in.
Oh, man. Yeah, you threw it all out there. Lots to deal with here. Okay, so I think probably most important to the listener is going to be the economic climate that we're in. So let's go over deal flow, underwriting. That's the fun part, the exciting part. Where are we at? For us, the last two quarters, and I haven't talked to you about this, Scott, so I'm curious on your end. Deal flow is pretty much went to a halt. Like, we have very little new deals. The deals that I did have in escrow, we're renegotiating. And like you said, primarily, even over interest rates, it's been our achieved rate. Like, what are we actually collecting in rent? And we are seeing that that's declining right now because of concessions, because of discounts, because of, we're not sure if it's lack of demand, but we are getting more move outs. But this is seasonal. So the next two quarters are going to be really important. We're going to see if that really picks it back up. So on the income side, we're down. So we basically canceled 80% of our deals. So deal flow is slowed down. I think to me, to speak to how we underwrite a deal, because I know we always get in the nitty gritty pretty much out of the gate. I like looking at the intrinsic value of the asset in the sense of what I mean by that is what is the stabilized cap rate or the unlevered yield based on where it is today versus where we can get it conservatively in 12 months. That gives us an idea of, regardless of financially engineering it with interest rates, where is that asset? What is it going to yield? What is that unit, that facility going to distribute out to us in cash? And then from there, can make that decision based on interest rates and our investors' expectations. But I don't want to too creative, right? Where we can't get that asset to the ultimate goal on a conservative ratio of what it's going to be valued. And we like to get typically to an 8.5% to 10% unlevered yield or stabilized cap rate in the next 24 months after we do all our value add and all the improvements. So yeah, that's kind of our metric to give people a clear direction on, like, maybe how to look through all these different metrics and nonsense in the economy. Okay, what is the asset going to actually generate for you of NOI?
We basically take the same approach. I'm a more visual person when it comes to underwriting. I mean, yes, it's a spreadsheet and we have our underwriting and we're always looking down at the bottom right, look at the NOI and what that looks like. And we first underwrite it for today's dollars, meaning, are we overpaying for this facility? Do we have everything? Have we included everything in our due diligence? And are we paying a fair price for it at the cap rate that was advertised, or at least that we feel comfortable with right now? So going into it, call it day one or in 30 days after the acquisition. And so we're going to look at that number to make sure that we're getting what we're paying for. Then we look out at the 12 month, just exactly as you stated. You know, well, we'll stress test it. We'll even be conservative, underwrite the expenses a little bit higher, call it short on the income, and still see if we love the deal at 12 months in terms of our underwriting. And then we're going to look out however long we think we're going to hold this. If this is a property that's going to go into our fund and we're going to hold this for 3 years or 5 years to the best of our abilities, what are our projections for what's going to happen in 4 years from now? Where do we feel the interest rates are going to be? How much value can we create? Which depends on where we bought it. Are the street rates 20% below the rest of the market right now? We know we'll have a big bump right now and we can ride it out. Is there expansion potential? Are we going to get a 2x return, or is this really something we're just going to bump rates up and we're going to run it more efficiently? And we should probably sell it in 2 years if we want to be able to bring in private equity to get the returns that our investors need. So there's those three sets of numbers that we underwrite to. The 12 months, just as you mentioned, we want to make sure that we're not overpaying for it, but then where are we going to take it? The 3, the 4, the 5 year. And then once we look at all three of those, then that's the intrinsic value for us. We know in our knowers, like this fits or it doesn't. But all along the way, as you mentioned, I'll just repackage it another way, which is we know what the interest rates are, which we know where the game is, the rules of the game are right now. And so we're going to underwrite it the same with that same 8 to 10 to 11% yield. And if it doesn't work past that, then yeah, we're on to the next.
Yeah, that's a good way to compartmentalize it, right? You got, where is it today? Mm-hmm. Where is it in 12 months? And then for us, yeah, where is it in 5 years? That gives us enough runway to get through maybe what interest rates are doing with the economic cycle of a recession or mm-hmm. whatever, how deep that's going to go. And that's when a lot of our loans are fixed to. We got that first mm-hmm. 5 years, we fix out that debt, that yep. timeline on mm-hmm. smaller type facilities that we have. So yeah, that's a good benchmark for people to look at for us. And I'm sure you probably deal with this. Two types of investors. You got one who's, give me my yield, multiple on invested capital, right? Mm-hmm. You know, MOIC. How many times are you going to double my money in this mm-hmm. period of time? And mm-hmm. then the other school of investor is, I don't care about getting it back. I don't even want it back. I don't want to deal with the gain. I just mm-hmm. want those steady distributions. Give me that 10%+ double digit cash on cash for the next 10+ years and let that asset go up in value. For me, it's trying to develop and build my business around, number one, what works for the business first, but mm-hmm. then two, around the capital demands or the capital preferences. There's a place for both, right? The mm-hmm. new development, the real yucky, non-performing existing assets that you improve and expand, mm-hmm. those are going to be people that need to be patient. You can't get those mm-hmm. cash on cash returns. And then your stabilized investors, we had to drop those expectations down. 6-8% is a damn good year one cash on cash yep. return right now. Yep. I'm balancing that. I mean, ultimately, I think it works well for anyone that's a small business owner in this business or entrepreneur, where you have to have that value add component, that capital has to understand it, and then getting it into a long-term like vehicle of more of a long-term stabilized fund or some type of long-term fixed mm-hmm. debts type structure where you're not under the gun to always sell these assets. Because you know how it is. You just like work so hard to get market share, meaning you dominate a market. You got a great clean asset. You got good debt on it. And then your fund runs out or your syndication, you know, that sucks. Like you got to sell mm-hmm. it off at that point. Even if it's a 6.5 cap or 6 cap, you know, in the old days, even high fives or whatever, mm-hmm. or maybe less, but to me, that's nice, but if you don't have another opportunity and then you're selling that asset, like it's very hard for me for the money to justify that asset, letting it go if I'm not doing something bigger and better.
So interesting, Jeremiah. We have folks we're talking about, and most indicators, we have two buckets of individuals that are wanting to invest with us. We have the folks that are wanting to set it and forget it. They're not looking for the home runs. They just want to protect their income. They don't want to have to actively invest it. And they're good with a little lower return. They don't want to have to continue to roll their money and go back out to the market. And in the meantime, it's not earning money for them while it's sitting on the sidelines. And for those folks, they can stay into a deal a little bit longer. Maybe we refinance the asset, they get some of their money back, and then they hold on for some stable cash flow, and we still have some properties that will appreciate and give them a decent return. And then we've got the other folks that are looking for cash flow out of the gate. And that typically comes in the form, as Jeremiah just mentioned, of these assets that we need to turn around, the troubled assets with the troubled owners, and we come in and clean them up, and it produces a lot of cash flow, and we're sending distributions out right out of the gate in the first quarter or the second quarter. The challenges, at least that I'm seeing, Jeremiah, is that folks are still, they're asking better questions, which is good. Some really hard questions of us, which again, they should be. It is their money that they're investing with. But sometimes these are questions that are timing of the market. And then more than anything, it is explaining to them, well, tell me where you're investing right now. And what is that going to yield to you? And what is that going to look like during the recession versus self-storage and what we've seen historically and what our projections are in this project? If I could maybe make that a little bit easier for you, Jeremiah. Yeah. How do you get these folks to get off the dime and show them that they can't be sitting on their cash right now? They can't be sitting in the S&P 500, which is historically returning 7%. If they're sitting on the sideline with inflation right now, they're losing 10 to 12 to 14%. What words are you using to either persuade or just highlight the fact that you got to get into the game? And so Sturge is the best game in town when it comes to the recession. And that these yields, as you mentioned, hey, they're not that bad. And as a matter of fact, where else are you going to beat it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I hate to be the guy that tries to get someone to do something or influence someone for me. And I know you don't either. You educate and people make their own decisions. So we don't really have a hard sales approach. Look at the big picture. So like you said, like, yeah, I've invested in a bunch of private equity, crypto and a few here and there and some other things, do AI, that stuff. I never really got my 10X that they all promised. Like knock it out of the park and make this huge return. I'm pretty tired of that, but whatever that. Real estate, tried and true, steady. That's why everybody's listening here. So for us, it's more of look at the big picture of how this fits in your asset allocation for your portfolio. And we all know the four key major like drivers of real estate. Obviously, cash flow is number one, and you can count on it. If you got a real asset and you got a good owner that's actually knows what they're doing in terms of like you and I, like a syndicator who can buy something strong, has the good fundamentals, low deferred maintenance. I mean, the asset itself will kick out cash. They got to be patient. They got to trust in the business plan that you know what you're doing, because we're all busy in this day and age. It's very competitive. We're all specializing in our own area of the marketplace, and you're never going to be able to do it as good as someone that puts all their effort into it. So we focus on that number one. I mean, appreciation is number two, where we all agree that it's inflation is going to be out of hand. Asset inflation is exactly what always occurs in the American economy, where they just keep printing more money and rich people chase great assets. That's just the bottom line. These assets aren't going away and they're going to appreciate. We got the tax benefits that are extremely advantageous, where we can continue to offset all our cash flow and go reinvest it and not pay tax until we get our gain. And we got the automatic savings account pay down. We're building equity just by paying that down. So for me, I just say, hey, look at the entire scope of the portfolio of this asset. How does this fit into your picture? Are you looking at it by just short term, where you want this 8 or 10% cash on cash right now? But are you willing to actually look at the real business behind it? And in 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 years, how are you going to benefit from all these other aspects of it, rather than just telling me that you get a 5.5% from some money market or treasury bill? It's only one very small piece of the puzzle.
Yep. 100%. That is that piece that, once again, as the intrinsic values are for us and the assets that we buy, there's an intrinsic value to the investment that these folks make passively, whether it in something that is throwing off cash flow from the beginning, or that they're going to maybe ride down a little bit and then 4 or 5 years from now receive the bigger payday. And so that is the challenge for us, is to be able to meet them wherever they're at in terms of their investment needs. And again, to educate them and let them draw their own conclusions. It has been a little bit interesting recently to be able to do so. Our crystal ball is in the shop right now and hasn't been functioning as well as we would like. But nevertheless, nothing changes in the business model for us in terms of the yield and the investments that we take on. If the cost of capital is higher, then we figure that into the underwriting. And then we do our best in terms of predicting when we're going to exit, and we still buffer that in terms of stress testing the cap rate on our exit. And that, folks, that is what most indicators do as well. And if they're not, and if they can't prove that, then there are probably some folks that you may not want to be doing a business with. And the good news in terms of folks that have been at this for a little while, and if I could take a time to highlight Jeremiah and what they've done over at Patriot, basically in the same boat that we have been, and that we see a little further down the road. 3 million square feet he's got under his belt. He's been doing this through a recession and has come out on the other side and knows how to create value as well during that time frame and exit and outperform the projections that he set out for his investors. And that is absolutely something that you need to be looking at when investing with somebody else. But let's shift gears a second, Jeremiah. Now let's talk about, I guess, pivots the adaptations from an owner-operator standpoint. We've seen, we've known, having gone through a recession, that self-storage benefit from that. So we're in the trauma and transition business, and there's a lot of trauma and transition in a recession, and people are moving, and businesses are downsizing, and that creates a demand for storage. And what we saw last time out was a huge run-up because there was less development because we had a banking recession that time, and so the lenders weren't lending on development. We haven't seen much of that slowdown. We may not see too much of that this time out. There's still going to be trouble in the economy. People and individuals are going to be downsizing, which allows us to be able to increase rates. But last time was that recession lasted so long that eventually something has to go in the budget. Once people run out of their unemployment or benefits and they can't find a job, it ain't going to be the Netflix bill, the cable bill. It's going to be their storage unit. And so that's what happened last time out. What do you see, or what do you project that you're seeing right now in terms of rental rates and consumer behavior and activity on the operations side? And what do you foresee happening, say, maybe in the next 12 to 18 months?
Oh man, that is the magic question. That's even more difficult than interest rates right there. Consumer behavior. The macro trends around this industry and psychological aspects of our business. It's a fascinating one, isn't it? I mean, affordable housing, commercial space for small bay industrial, those parts of my portfolio are pretty simple to figure out, right? People are going to need it. They got to do business somewhere. They got to live somewhere. With storage, we're still understanding this threshold of how important is it to the customer, right? And what are the macro conditions in someone's personal life and the economic environment and their professional life? What creates more demand? And this is like, I don't think anyone knows. We've sat down with the CEOs of some of the public companies, and I'm not impressed by some of the answers on their trends of what they project. I think we just read the past data and say there's past trends equal future success and performance. But I mean, not to skate around the question, I would say what we're seeing is less activity than during the COVID explosion. You probably had other guests on there that even on the public level, the public reads 20% year-over-year revenue growth for 2 years is insane in real estate. I don't think I've never seen it in my lifetime. Right. I don't think any that's ever happened. So that wasn't sustainable. So now we're seeing the hangover after that. And what I'm noticing is it's always that kind of bait and switch, for lack of a better term. Get people in at the low rate, get them in for free, you know, get their stuff and then crank up those rates slowly but surely. So I would say, I don't think the consumer behavior is going to stop. And I hope I'm not biased here, but I think that people are going to continue to demand more storage based on consumption activities. Yeah. And I believe that the World War II generation still has an influence on my generation and even probably the tail end of some of the early millennials. It's very hard for us to throw away large things after you've worked so hard to accumulate it or just acquire it. So I think the demand curve is going to continue to go up over time. I think suburban and tertiary markets are going to continue to have success. And I think that you have to be a little more diversified on your customer product. So I like this a little more small bay commercial space, a little bit of boat and RV space, a little bit more, a little climate control space. And then obviously the drive up is the bread and butter. So I think if you start to get more of in tune of that, and then making the process as simple as possible for our customer, one where you're driving AdWords and they find you, and then making that simple process the least. Yeah, I think we're going to be successful there. Yeah. But I think this year revenue is going to be down, and that's just my projection. But I think long term, for two more years, I think we're going to be sitting in a good place, because I think new starts are going to start to slow down because of material costs. Banking, like we said, is very difficult to get now, development loans, and then just personal risk appetite. Like right now, when revenue's down and there's a lot more competition, like it takes a lot of stones, right? You got to really be able to make sure that you know what you're doing, or you're taking a big risk when you got an empty facility to fill up.
Listen, there has never been a better time to invest in self-storage, and there's no better team than ours to show you how to do it, because we wrote the book on how to invest in self-storage. Literally, we created the best-selling home study system titled How to Find, Evaluate, Purchase, and Manage Self-Storage Facilities. We have helped thousands of people launch and scale their self-storage business and have become the nation's go-to resource for all things self-storage. That's because we not only talk the talk, we walk the walk, day in and day out since 2005 through now, two recessions and amassing a 2.5 million square feet of self-storage, totaling over 15,000 doors nationwide. There is nobody else that has more experience in self-storage that is teaching people how to invest in self-storage. So if you're ready to launch and scale your self-storage business, then go to selfstorageinvesting.com. Click on the events tab to grab your ticket to the upcoming Self-Storage Academy. So that again is selfstorageinvesting.com. Click on the events tab. Seating is limited. And on behalf of our team, we look forward to seeing you then. Take care.
Yeah. Let's pull on the thread of consumer behavior just for kicks. And we can just, let's bat this back and forth a little bit. Looking back historically, we're seeing that the size of the average household in the US from the 1960s up until 2007 basically doubled. Average home size used to be, I mean, it was like literally doubled. It was like over 1,000 square foot more. It used to be like 980 square feet. in the 60s was the average home size with a 1 to 1.5 car garage. And then we ended up at like literally 1983. So like 1,983 square feet back in 2007. Then it creeped up right before the recession to like over 2,200. And then it popped back down post-recession. Now we're down in the 1,700-1,800 square feet. And so are you seeing an effect on that? Do you think that has an effect? And that's the average. What we're seeing also these communities that are more community-based, whether they're retirement or not, just smaller living spaces, but bigger open common areas, and also people moving back into the cities into high rises or 3-4 story condos being smaller and generating more demand for storage. Is that a real thing? Are you seeing that? Do you think that that is a demand driver for storage?
There's a correlation for sure, right? The size of space that we are in the space business.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that the more space people have, the less demand for storage. That's one aspect of it now. And I think the trend is going to continue to move forward. Like you said, smaller spaces, it's inevitable, mm-hmm. right? Cost, there's just mm-hmm. pure inputs are going up. So that I think demand driver is going to increase. My big question is, what are the patterns of the younger generation? I think, you know, I'm 40, I'm turning 42. I think we still mm-hmm. have this idea that we need to keep stuff. And mm-hmm. the older generation to me definitely holds their things. And mm-hmm. I think that they're going to utilize storage per capita more. The average customer, the older customer is going to use it more. I'm mm-hmm. curious about that wave underneath me, the people in their 20s and 30s. The problem with them is that they, and like my sister still lives at home. A lot of my friends, she's in her 20s. She's a 25, 26. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious with, they don't have the opportunity to get a lot of space and they're not really buying housing. That's not mm-hmm. there. So, and they're very transient and we're mm-hmm. moving all over the place. So I think that's going to be a strong driver where they're going to have to adapt with the lack of options, and the mm-hmm. storage might be that we all have that set of furniture we worked our butt off to get, and you just don't want to throw it away and you keep it in storage. So I think that trend's going to continue to go up.
Yeah. So I had written an article years ago for ISS about the demand that the boomers were placing on the storage industry. They have two homes, you know, the snowbirds that live up north where you and I live. They have a second home down south. They'll put their stuff in storage when they move back to the north for the summer and rent it out, and likewise in the winter. And they've just accumulated stuff, boats, RVs, the homeowners associations won't allow it there. And when they downsize to a smaller home and then assisted living, and then when they pass on, each and every one of those times, it creates a need for storage, or at least an additional storage unit or more storage. And that is just part of that generation. So the fear in the industry was millennials. They're buying smaller homes. They're staying home, as you mentioned. They don't have this propensity for stuff. They have a propensity to create experiences, and they don't want to buy a house. They don't want to commit long-term. They want to be able to move around. They are more transient. Then what we found, and I was trying to pull this up as you were talking about this, and I think it was Sparefoot or it may have been Inside Self-Storage. I need to get proper due, but there was a study that was done about the millennials as well as Gen Z that's coming along. And yes, they're transient. Yes, they're staying at home and they do like their experiences. And because they like those experiences, their skis, their camping equipment, their boats, their travel equipment, whether it be campers or camping gear or whatever that else, has to go in storage because they're living in a tiny house or they're living in a condo, they're living in an apartment, and there's very little storage in those as well. And so the study had showed that the demand for storage per person for this generation coming up beyond the boomers, behind the boomers in the millennials and Generation X, they have a higher propensity and a higher demand for storage. And so rest assured, folks, for everybody listening out there that's in storage right now, it isn't a generational decline in a demand for storage. It's actually increasing. And so whether those changes in how we live and the size of our homes or our apartments and being transient in nature, if that's going to continue to be an upward trend, remains to be seen. But for right now, it appears as if the demand definitely is there and increasing.
Yeah, if I were to look at it like an alien and I looked at our planet and I see the behavior of people and I saw the younger, the people that haven't been around as long and the old people that have, and I look at those younger people, I'd say, okay, what's the predominant religion of our society? Consumption. And that's not going away. So whatever, every single message that we receive is, if you acquire this, it's going to make you, transform you and be better. So that is the aspiration of every single person, any way they want to slice it. I mean, I'm talking population generalization as a whole.
Understood.
So yeah, so I would say, okay, if people are going to consume things, small, big, medium size, and they cannot acquire any more space because it prohibits, they just don't have income. They don't have the ability. It's not there. The cost is so much higher. That stuff has to go somewhere. Yeah. So I'm betting on that they're going to have to put it somewhere in storage and they're not going to throw it away.
Yep.
All of it. They're not throwing 100%. Everything away.
100%. Interesting. I've had the same thoughts myself with regards to an alien coming down and looking at how we derive a value as human beings. And it is by our stuff. And then also, I wondered if an alien looked inside of an LA Fitness or a Planet Fitness and wondered, why are these people lifting all these things and doing all this stuff? No real goal behind it. They would never understand it if we tried to explain it to them. But for the same reason, we derive value in how we look as well as the stuff that we have. But I digress. Let's talk about the other piece that you mentioned, Jeremiah. And this is a piece that we're looking into and making plans for as well. The smaller warehousing, but larger than a storage unit, looking at the last mile. Self-storage is the last mile in the logistics and distribution hubs. Amazon continues to come out further and further and further. There's a demand from the suppliers on all ends of that supply chain, including Amazon and other retailers, for that last mile. And self-storage is the best alternative for it right now in terms of the footprint currently, but then building and creating spaces that are in those 500 to 1,000, 2,500 square foot spaces. And then also creating even the smaller office flex and having maybe it is just one shared business unit that we have, our conference room that we have, or some of those units that do have a small office in the front of it. We've seen a lot of those in Texas currently and other places around the country. I feel that that's going to be a morphing of self-storage and that we're going to begin to see storage used as, and as we build more of it, that it is going to have some of those larger units with the last mile of the logistics hub in mind. Is that what you're seeing and what you're referring to?
Yeah, I love that part of the business. I think that adaptation is definitely going to be a trend that the early adopters are going to benefit from. Mm-hmm. So we're doing it in the Northeast. We're seeing so many different demand needs of that type of space. And what I mean, that type of space, like you said, large units, larger doors, sometimes a man door next to it, sometimes a shared bathroom, or they even have a bathroom or electricity, low voltage. So those things, that is critical for not only last mile, but just commercial users in general, where the painter needs to put his paints there. We got the landscaper that needs some of the basic equipment there. The guy that wants to just get out of the house, who's in his 60s, who's driving, his wife's going crazy because he's at home all the time. The guy's going to get out there and work on something in his little garage. You know, and these don't have to be the fancy ones in Florida for $300,000 or $500,000. I think communities all over the country need these. And then there's obviously the aspect of a small little bit of 3PL, like you said, the distribution stuff. But I think that those multi-dimensions of normal storage versus commercial storage, and then even a little bit of that flex space. I think the entrepreneurial nature of, I don't know what the statistics are, but I don't think it's going to change, where job growth is like 70 or 80% of small businesses, right? We are leading the country in terms of the business climate. So, and they need space at some way. How we're going to provide that to them, that's going to evolve. I love that model. We're actually doing even shared loading docks in a few of our new developments, where there's a forklift that you can rent out and then come in there and borrow it to get your loading dock deliveries and bring it over to your unit.
Many, many years ago, I was looking for an office space, about 2,000 square foot office for myself and a small staff. And I was looking for maybe to be a larger building where it had some tenants in it. I get my rent for free. I get my office space for free. We ended up buying a 200,000 square foot building. It was an old industrial distribution center that had office, it had storage, it had cold storage, refrigerated space, you name it. It was like a lesson or a case study in commercial real estate. It had all of it. It had parking, it had truck parking. And what we found is in that space is there was a whole lot of folks that wanted office space and they wanted 10,000 square foot. And this was after the recession and back in 2009 and 10. And now we're seeing that was in high demand for that same person. Get out of the house. The basement is too small now. Kitchen table doesn't work. Starbucks is too expensive and too loud. So I need a small office and I need some warehousing space and some of the larger. And so by de facto, that was a great place to come. We've shied away from it in storage, speaking about myself personally, and I think others as well, because when you start to mix the asset classes and have more office in it or a car wash, then all of a sudden your pool of buyers gets really, really small when it comes time to exit, because storage folks are primarily storage folks. Typically, they don't want to be running office and spaces and managing those. They don't want to be handling car washes and things of that nature. And we've stayed away. But now we're also seeing a demand by these cities that really don't like self-storage if we're trying to do an urban infill location. But if you can do some co-working space on the ground floor where people are walking past and the city officials drive past, they just don't want to see storage either. But then above, stories 2, 3, and 4 above are storage. Now, all of a sudden, they're saying, well, that provides a need in both instances for the city, and we'll approve that for a conversion or for a development. And so by de facto, we've seen a mixture of those work with co-working space, and the folks are using storage because it's ideal for them. It's not just a bifurcation of the types of tenants being only co-working in office spaces down below, and those folks are there, and then the storage tenants are above. They're using it as office space, and then storage because their warehousing is above for their small business. And I believe that we're going to begin to see more of that morphing of this incubator space or the flex space, but more in a working environment, like a co-working environment, shared office space as a larger component with the storage above as well. And so, and we're seeing this, to be honest with you, Jeremiah, if you look around the world, we're seeing more self-storage is being built more that way, I would say, than just a traditional storage building. And so, yes, we're the pioneers of self-storage, but if we start to look at other places around the world, I think they're a little bit more progressive in how they're handling self-storage and how it's morphing into other asset classes.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, that seems poignant, and it's on track with exactly what I'm seeing. We pretty much play in suburban and tertiary markets, but for us on the frontage of our developments, the towns definitely want a different type of use. They want to promote jobs. There's only so much storage they want to allow in their town because, I mean, it's property tax revenue, but really no job growth. So it's been a helpful aspect of our company to pivot and help get approvals through that method. And then we look at it where the shared office structure is more like it's a business park. So it's not as limited as an urban environment, but you have your 20 by 50. So you got your 1,000 square foot chunks of units, and you can do whatever you want in your unit. You can build out a little office, or we can even supply something like that. But I mean, you have a shared bathroom in the community, and there might be an office, property management office, where we have the forklift and they'll help pick up your deliveries or even possibly help you do some invoicing or something in the future. But we want to keep it really compartmentalized that we don't care if you put an RV, we don't care if you run your business, or we don't care if you just play around in there and just as a man cave. This is the opportunity to have your own space and do whatever you want there.
Yep. Perfect. Well, Jeremiah, as we wrap up, you and I have been through some recessions. We've seen the industry evolve and do well during those times. We're getting ready to head into the next one. And we're working with folks that are looking to invest with us. We're teaching people how to go about and do the business. And there's a whole lot of folks that are pulling back and sitting on the sidelines in both instances. And we all know that the millionaires were created and the great businesses were built during these times and not sitting on the sidelines. So call it advice, call it encouragement. What words of wisdom, having been through that in good markets and bad markets, what would you have for the folks out there right now? Maybe you're sitting back waiting. What would you say to those folks?
Yeah, I think CNN Money has this greed, fear balance. They have that index, you know, and right now it's quite swayed to the fear portion of it. So what I would say is, you have to, like Buffett says, if you can't control your emotions, you can't control your money. So stick with the plan. Like if they're listening to this, somebody's thinking about doing something in storage. So really buckle down on the fundamentals of what do you believe in your thesis. Don't let anyone influence you. Do what you think is right for your individual situation. Now, and don't be greedy. Right now, it's just stick with the fundamentals. If you like storage and you know what a good storage facility, what the attributes are, stay focused on that. Don't get all worried about getting a smoking deal or getting something at auction or whatever that is. I mean, that stuff might happen. It might not. But really, it's like, look at the good, solid assets. Are you putting your money in something that's going to work over 10 years, 20 years? Or are you just trying to chase something in the moment? And if you come from that perspective, I think you make a lot better decisions in the long haul. It's a lot less stress on your life.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Well, maybe an add-on question to that, Jeremiah, you've been at this a long time as well. What is one of the biggest challenges that you've faced in your investing career that you were able to overcome? And how did that turn out?
The first thing that comes to my head is operations. I mean, the deal is great. I love finding a good deal. And that I didn't have a problem really understanding or getting pretty good at. It really was evaluating the business behind, this is a true business. This is an operating business. So for me, it was doubling down on the efforts of understanding the nuances of our business because it's not just collecting rent. So the obstacle was understanding all of the functions of the business, the functions of the different departments, the team leaders. So, I mean, if I had to streamline it into something, it would be more of really running your business in real estate like a typical company where you provide value to your customer. Always think about your customer because that truly is how we make the money for our investors. And if you don't provide them value, you're never going to make it.
Yeah, one of those industries or one of the asset classes in commercial real estate that truly has a business that is bolted onto it. And many people don't realize that it's not a set it and forget it. And you have to walk the four corners and you have to maximize NOI. And there's a lot that goes into that. Yeah, I learned the same hard lesson. And I think it took me longer just because I'm a hunter. I am not a farmer. And I just didn't really care to dig into the operation side of the business. And so once the deal was done, it's just like, I'm just bored. Now let's go find the next. And it's like, oh, wait a minute. We got to build a business behind it because that is the business. It's not just the buildings. So yeah, then the business building comes in within buying or hiring good lieutenants and then bringing them in to be able to run that side of the business if you don't possess that. And I don't know of a unicorn out there who is really, really good at both or really, really enjoys doing both, choosing one or the other. And I can tell you the farmer ain't me. I am the hunter.
Yeah, I would say to tag on to your comment there is that for me, underestimating the value of people, and it's such a trite thing to say, but the true wins at this stage of my career are not even the deal. I mean, the deal is amazing. I love to get great deals. I've never known when you say the saying, who, not how, the who, one key person in your organization times five can dramatically change your life and your business model and the returns you provide to people. Mm-hmm. I did not realize that until the last few years, and I'm still learning it every single day. And I think, but if you're a better leader, constantly work on yourself in terms of every aspect of this business, you can identify and attract those types of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same path to the point that on my computer at home on the monitor is a little yellow post-it note that says just that, who, not how, because I'm myself trying to figure out how I'm going to solve this problem, this challenge, or how am I going to find time to be able to fix this? I have to stop and remind myself it's not me and it's not how. It's not, I need to hire somebody who is really, really good at this, or if there's somebody on staff right now and get this off my plate. So 100%. Otherwise, you're going to be stuck. You're just going to be stuck because not only is it not going to get done well if you don't know how to do it, but then that won't free up time for you to go out and dive into your superpower, just being the visionary and going out and raising capital and doing more deals, plain and simple. So there's an opportunity cost of not having the right people in place as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Spot on, man. We're our heads in the same place.
All right, Jeremiah, once again, so good to catch up. I'm glad that we were able to do round two. Folks, the show notes will also show you how and where to find Jeremiah and Patriot and everything that they're doing there, as well as links to our last session, which you don't want to miss as well. So with that, Jeremiah, I appreciate your time so much and looking forward to our next conversation to catch up with what's going on in the storage market.
You got it. Thanks, Scott.
All right. Take care, Jeremiah.
Hey, gang. Wait. Three things before you leave. First, don't forget to subscribe to the Self Storage Podcast and turn on your notifications so you never miss another episode. And while you're there, please leave us a 5-star review if you like the show. Second, be sure to share your favorite episodes and more via Instagram, and don't forget to tag us. And lastly, head to the links in the show description and hit the following subscribe button on Twitter and Facebook to get a front row seat as we grow and scale our business and bring you along with us. Take care.